We are approaching, we're getting near the end of a series on stewardship, God's way. We've looked at the basic concept of managing our lives for God from a number of different angles. And we've applied those ideas specifically to money and to all of God's gifts to us and to our careers. Today, we reach into the thoughts of one of the wisest men who ever lived, to whom God declared, "I will give you a wise and discerning heart so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be." I refer to Solomon, son of David, who wrote Ecclesiastes. Today we consider one of the most famous things this wise man ever said. Some very well-known poetry in chapter 3 that speaks of our stewardship of time. There is a time for everything, and a season for every activity under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to mend, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. This text is captivating in its beauty. We instinctively sense that something very important is being said here. Ancient Hebrew has two rules that help us to grasp Solomon's intent. His intent is all in the first phrase. There's a time for everything. And then he develops that to bring it out. And he does it in two ways. One way Hebrew would do this is to use pairs of opposites to include everything in between them. And so we began the service by saying, from the rising of the sun to its setting, may the name of the Lord be praised. From the east to the west, where's that? Well, that's everywhere. Or Psalm 49, "Hear this, all you people, listen all who live in the world, both low and high, rich and poor," low and high, rich and poor, who's that? Well, that's everybody in the world. It said it, but then it went ahead and elaborated on it by giving these opposites. By using opposing pairs, gather, scatter, search and give up, so on, Solomon declares that there is a time for everything. After he initially says that, time for everything, a season for every activity under heaven. And then the second rule that we recognize in this text is the use of repetition to highlight or underline. They didn't have highlighting or underlining, but what they had was repetition to say a thing and make it even stronger. And Solomon uses 14 pairs, opposing pairs, of generally positive and negative experiences. You put all that together, and he's saying, look, there really, 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 really is time for absolutely everything, okay? The only boundary suggested is the word translated here, activity. The Hebrew is not a neutral word. It doesn't mean just thing. It's actually a word that suggests something good or something pleasing or appropriate. Solomon is not saying, therefore, that all kinds of good and bad things are just going to happen to you. He's saying that all kinds of things may be appropriate for us to pursue from time to time. It's not that some things are to be pursued all the time and some things always avoided, but there are times when any of these things may be genuinely appropriate. Solomon was writing about purpose, not about chance. In fact, the King James is famous for translating that word activity as purpose. There's a purpose for everything. In different seasons of life, our purpose should be directed appropriately. At any given time, our purpose should correspond with what our current situation demands. Now, Solomon's intent, I think, is obscured by the NIV, the way it translates the second verse, a time to be born and a time to die, because a person doesn't focus on their purpose while being born. That's a passive thing. But the verb here really should be translated to give birth. And that's how the New American Standard translates it. And by the way, if you ever want to know what a verb tense is in the Hebrew or Greek, look at the New American Standard. It's not always the best translation, but it always gives you the right verb tense, as it does here. There is, at any rate, there's a time to focus on bringing life into the world. And there's a time to focus on leaving the world. That makes it consistent with the whole thing. In other words, life happens in seasons. Just like the seasons of a year, certain things are characteristic of each season, and our attention should be focused on the things that are characteristic of the season we're in. You don't plant when it's time to harvest. Wisdom is going to do. Wisdom will think and act in ways appropriate to one's season of life at the time. Not that there's the same season for everybody necessarily, but the season that we're in. What's going on with us right now? And to do otherwise would be meaningless. It would be silly to do otherwise. And that's what makes it a good candidate here for Ecclesiastes, because Ecclesiastes is about all kinds of meaningless things that we do, and few people will live this way. The proper stewardship, the godly stewardship of our time, requires that we focus on what is really happening, on what reality is right now, not on the memory of some season gone by, or anticipation of some season yet to come, but the season we're living in right now. Proper stewardship deals with present realities. It doesn't ignore them by living in a fantasy world of our own making. The stewardship of our time cannot afford denial or obsession or self-deception. It cannot rely on solutions that we prefer, whether or not they're suited to the problem we're facing. The stewardship of time faithfully manages each season of life as it occurs, waging war when war must be waged, and waging peace when war would be out of line. Ignore the season that you're in, ignore reality, and it can cost you your health, it can cost you your job or your business, it can cost you your marriage or your ministry. I was first introduced to time management way back in my college days. Actually, it was with InterVarsity. They taught us about managing time. I used a half a dozen of these things. I mean just different kinds. I was always looking for a better one, thinking that it would help me do my time better, you know? Different sizes and different, you know, combinations of things. That was a long time ago. I mean, I was also using these things back then, too. Now, if you don't know what this is, you need to ask, I was going to say your parents, but you better ask your grandparents what that is. Anyway, now I'm all modern and I use something else. But you know something? I've discovered something very, very, very strange. No matter how fancy, no matter how expensive a system I've used, I've never gotten more than 24 hours out of a day. Actually, one of your elders still uses 3x5 cards. He's used them for years, and I think he's more organized than I am. Solomon's comments reveal a major shortcoming in all of these time management systems. They all deal with techniques for scheduling things, our meetings and our to-dos and our projects. They keep those things organized so you can cram as much as possible in a day, but none of them tell you what you ought to be doing. They help us measure and juggle a variety of commitments, but none of them evaluate what commitments we ought to have, particularly in the light of our changing seasons. My old daytimer or my iPhone today doesn't tell me what I should be spending more or less time on now, at this point in my life, in response to what's happening to me in all of life's contexts. And if anything, these kind of tools tend to put my patterns and my current patterns and my current habits on rails, preventing them from changing, even when those patterns ought to change. If you've never read the little booklet, Tyranny of the Urgent, by Charles Hummel, you really ought to. You can still get it. It's still available. And Mr. Hummel dealt with how life can be so frustrating and overwhelming. Let me just quote. He said, "When we stop to evaluate, we realize that our dilemma goes deeper than shortage of time. It's basically the problem of priorities. Hard work does not hurt us. Not hard work, but doubt and misgiving produce anxieties. We review a month or a year and become oppressed by a pile of unfinished tasks. We sense uneasily that we may have failed to do the important. The winds of other people's demands have driven us onto a reef of frustration. We live in constant tension between the urgent and the important. The problem is that the important task rarely must be done today or even this week, but the urgent tasks call for instant action, endless demands, pressure every hour and day. That's part of what Solomon was talking about, that different seasons make different things important. But it's always easier just to do what I'm used to doing and what I've always been doing, or what I want to do, or what other people want me to do. The winds of other people's demands have driven us into a reef of frustration. What a line. Demands from individuals, demands from institutions. There are enough demands, not just to fill up our schedule, but to fill it up many times over, regardless of what we ought to be doing. And yet, even though it isn't on your schedule of things to do, there are times for things. There is a time, for example, to mourn. I say this because funeral arrangements are urgent things, and we have lots to decide, lots to organize. We set times for viewings and memorials and maybe gather after the service. But grief is more than that. You can't schedule grief like that or assume it's over when your time off from work is done and you do have to get back. Grief is painful, so we try to avoid it, which just extends it. We try to ignore this. The season of mourning is upon us, and just try to move on as if our grief didn't exist. But there is a season to weep. Not a day, not a week, but a season, a time to learn deep lessons about life with God. Some very hard. Some very wonderful. Sometimes it's a time to dance. It's a time to stop and appropriately recognize important milestones and achievements, not just let them go by. Sometimes they're captured in special events like weddings or anniversaries, but there are times to laugh and give the blessings and the joys and our gratitude the air they need to breathe and the time that they deserve. Sometimes it's right to keep, to shore up and store away memories, memories of people and events and experiences that molded us, that in a good way made us the people that we are today. But sometimes it's better to throw away, to finally face experiences and events and people who twisted us, who contributed to our fears and to our shame. There comes a time in your life when you're mature enough to deal with that. And when that season comes, do it. There are times that are right for planting and times that are right for uprooting. That's true for bushes and trees, planted for a particular reason, but maybe now, years later, they've outgrown their usefulness. Maybe they're not so healthy anymore. Or maybe your landscaping needs change. Well, the same is true for institutions and programs and ministries. Beginning a new thing at just the right time. Why, that is an entrepreneur's dream or a minister's dream. To create something that takes advantage of the Spirit's wind or of the waves that hit our culture. Such enterprises take off. But all waves pass, and the Spirit's wind is famous for coming and going as He wills. And there comes a time when the ground may be better used by uprooting, planting something else. Sometimes it is best to refrain from embracing. Fornication before marriage is like smoking, a lot of smoking or a lot of tanning when you're a teen. It seems so harmless and it's so much fun, but it leaves you open to cancer in years to come. Emotional, spiritual cancer, relationships with weakened immune systems, unable to cope with natural stresses. There's also a time to embrace, to keep a marriage strong through regular, faithful, thoughtful intimacy. Now, what that looks like will change over a lifetime, but relationships can become emaciated and sickly without it. Sometimes it's very important to tear, to put an end to friendships that are either unproductive or actually toxic. Commitments and memberships, magazine subscriptions, or maybe a cultural, philosophical, political idea that is unworthy of a Christian that you inherited, and it's time to let go. But sometimes it's equally important to mend, to put a final end to a conflict which serves no good purpose, to learn how to confess sin well, to learn how to forgive well, and to find with God peace with the hurts that were inflicted by people no longer alive. There's a time to speak when honesty and love demand it, and when your voice combined with everything else might be just enough to nudge a speeding raft around a deadly rock. But there's also a time to be silent when what we would say would only give vent to our frustrations and bitterness and self-righteousness. There is a time to kill. Literal warfare, sometimes. Spiritual warfare, definitely. A time when we recognize the enemy within and habits of thinking and behavior which we simply must put to death. And there's a time to heal, a healing season, a time to recognize and admit to ourselves that God is alive in us, to celebrate the good he's done and is doing and be content with his will. There's a time to give birth, to invest heavily, all we have, in the future of mankind. For we're not only entrusted by God with the present and the present needs and the present opportunities, but we are guardians of the future, responsible to prepare the generation who will replace us. And if that's true, then there is a time to die. When our tour at the front lines is over, when someone stronger and fresher takes our position at any age, really, when our work is done, not clawing at every scrap of medical wizardry as if our lives depended on it. Christian, our lives do not depend on it. Jesus said, "Whoever lives and believes in me will never die." Some seasons come earlier, some later than we expect. But when it is our season to die, then let us direct our purpose to that as much as in any other season. Friends, the pace of life is so unrelenting. I believe the only way to stay up with the seasons is to devote time to prayer and meditation on his word. We've got to stop. We've got to make ourselves evaluate where we're at. What's going on? Where is the hull going to breach if it's not reinforced? What opportunities are open for a time which shall never come again? If you need a wake-up call to see how little direction we typically run with, try a discipline that was outlined by a business author. His name was Peter Bregman. He says it takes him 18 minutes a day to keep himself on track. 18 minutes a day. He said you take 5 minutes in the morning. 5 minutes in the morning to answer what are the most important things for me to work on today. Most people don't do that. You go right to email or something, right? Take 5 minutes. What are the most important things for me to do today? Then he says in the evening, take 5 minutes to answer the question, what did I learn from today? What did I accomplish? Did I accomplish what's most important? And if I didn't, why not? And then the intriguing part, for the 8 hours in between, stop every hour for 1 minute. Every hour, he says, set your alarm. Stop every hour for one. Stop. And ask yourself if you spent the last hour well, and if you need to change your plans to spend the next hour better. Well, that's not bad as a wake-up call to how unfocused we are and how easily distracted we become. But even that system is fatally flawed because it still doesn't tell me what ought to be important from God's perspective. For that, we've got to escape from the pressure for a bit. We call it retreating or going on retreat, not in the sense of giving up the battle, but in the sense of disengaging for a short while, partly to regather strength, but mostly to gather a sense of perspective. Have things changed since I put my head down and started running forward? Have conditions changed? Has the field changed? It's like pulling into a rest stop to get gas and look at a map. The map, of course, is God's word. The Bible is God's mind in your hands, just waiting to engage your mind. Through the Bible, God's mind finds you. The Holy Spirit uses it to find you, no matter where you are. And just like John is pictured in the book of Revelation, he sweeps you up into heaven so you can see, through God's revelation, you can see history. You can see your life from his perspective. It's not that the little details of life that absorb us become less important. It's just that you can see them again as little details and part of something bigger. Of course, retreating is not only taking in, it's responding. Responding to God is what we call prayer. It's talking to him. There are lots of books about prayer. Some of them are very, very good. But it's not really that complicated a thing. In fact, I mean, the more you think about it while you're doing it, the more awkward it is when you're supposed to just be talking. I remember the first time I asked a girl for a date over the phone. I actually had a conversation tree. If she says this, I'm going to say this. Now, if she says this, I'm going to say this. And I had this, and I had it down about three levels, and I was good to go, okay? It was a pleasant time. Didn't date again, but it was a pleasant time. Okay. Don't have to do that. Just let your prayers flow out of what you find in the scriptures. And you start having genuine conversations with God. Seeing things from his perspective is going to stimulate all kinds of questions, not even the ones you came with, but other questions come up. Let them flow. You will learn a lot just by discovering the questions you have. And as helpful as 5 minutes with God here and there can be, God's truth is like coffee. It has to steep a bit in your brain and in your heart. You need to talk with him for some time. And as you do, God will give you wisdom and answer to your prayers. You regain a sense of where you are, what season you're in. When's the best time to do that? I can't help but just reflect again that God has already told us that. He told us not to kill, and he told us not to commit adultery, and he told us to take one day in seven and give it to him. We need that time. Stop working and rest in him. That includes freeing yourself from all of your employments and all of your school commitments and everything else. Now, if you can't do that on Sunday, then find another time. But take time, find it somewhere to set apart for God half an hour or more alone with him. I do it best in the evening. I'm a night owl. Many like the morning. It doesn't matter. Let your spouse take the kids. Enjoy the luxury of God's presence. Let God show you the seasons of life, how your life is changing. Let him unlock the chain of habit that binds you to your daily routine so you can walk around a little bit in freedom, looking at your options. Should you be steering your life a little bit differently now? What commitments have run their course? What new things does God want to work alongside you to accomplish now? And make it a point to have a personal retreat once or twice a year. They used to have feasts in the Old Testament. People would, they'd leave their jobs, whatever, for a week or more, traveling and then getting back. Time enough to really disengage from your normal routine. Vacation sounds like a great time to do this, but beware. Could be deceitful. Vacations can be as demanding as any other time. In fact, they can be filled with urgent demands, and sometimes it's even less easy to get privacy. On the Sabbath, I think of it this way. You climb the nearest hill you can find, and you just kind of get your bearings. But on a personal retreat, you climb a mountain to see where you are on your whole journey. Get oriented. You know, Jesus would go out alone to pray. He'd take special time to be alone with his Father from a single hour to a month. He needed time to keep track of his time, to keep track of his seasons, so he could say to the disciples, it's not time for that yet, or it is time now. And when he died, it was with that wonderful phrase dispersed over a confused and fearful crowd, it's finished. There's so much Jesus did not do, so much he didn't have time for, but he finished the most important thing. He made time for that. What a tragedy it would have been if Jesus had missed the cross because his schedule in Capernaum just wouldn't permit it. There's a time for everything, a season for everything God expects of you, everything he looks forward to doing with you. What a shame to miss anything because our schedule would not permit it. Let's pray. Father, even a worship service sort of is packed, has a schedule, has a liturgy. Many things we do here, we hope, will prepare us to spend our time well in the coming week. But in the next 5-10 minutes, we do have the luxury of time. Singing's not very stressful, and we can even pause that if we want to. We're aware of our family and our friends. This time is mostly between you and me. And today, during this time, we ask for the wisdom of Solomon. We ask for the clarity to perceive the season we are passing through and to see what you would like to do with us during this season right now.